Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. A couple of weeks ago, we explored some ideas about the relationship between ethics and science as sort of part of this wider consideration of a newish book based on some research about what might happen to society if people walked away from religion from the article that that Tim brought in. And one of the things that I really appreciated and still appreciate about the emphasis in that book as it was sort of as it was unpacked in the article, I haven't read the book, but was its even-keeledness. It didn't feel like, I mean, the authors sort of went so far as to say, in maybe not so many words, but they weren't trying to create a crisis. They were trying to be true to the data, like researchers tend to be, but their conclusion was that they were basically contending that their research said that leaving religion wasn't the harbinger of any kind of societal collapse. It was almost a non-event when it comes to how people might live, for example, their ethical lives in terms of doing what is good and so on. And I experienced that just as a sense of tremendous relief. And not just because of the conclusion, yes, that too, but the other side of it, when I reflected on it a bit more, I realized the other side of it was that I sometimes feel just deeply weary of being surrounded by people and institutions that usually in the name of the big themes of wealth and power keep trying to force feed me a diet of fear. I just that just makes my soul tired, among other things. I know I am, and I believe that as humans, generally speaking, we all are wired to respond really powerfully to fear. And at the root of that, at least from an evolutionary biology point of view, at the root of that is this instinct towards self-preservation. So far, so reasonable, I think. Where I think this can really go off the rails is when self-preservation gets conflated with self-interest. It's a murky zone in there for sure. But particularly if self-interest is regarded, believed to be, the essential path to a good life. So if we zoom out a little bit, I think it's pretty easy to see that there needs to be, a tension, a perennial, even helpful tension between self-interest and common interest or common good. There's always a pull between those things, I think, in our human experience. If we take that and we tilt it to its extremes, I think we can sort of see this. If we tilt human behavior and motivation all the way towards self-interest and sort of build a society around that, we're likely to get a society that is comprised of people that are all trying to be the one on top, all trying to sort of win through self-interest. If we tilt it all the way toward the common good, we might tend to get a society that's comprised of people who have no idea who they are apart from, or perhaps even within the group. So you get groupthink. Those are sort of the extremes. I think what's noteworthy is that common good is not synonymous with all think the same. I think that's a kind of an important distinction. Okay, so with that little mini rant, you know, in view but not in charge, what I want to do is dig into some reflection on the relationship between religion and ethics. And in that, some of that same general kind of tension is going to show up in this, but maybe not in the ways we've been taught to expect it. And also, just an FYI on this one, some of this is going to be a little bit heady. I don't feel apologetic about that, given the usual mix of things we consider here, especially our alt Sundays tend to not be that way so much more discussion-oriented and group-oriented, but I wouldn't want it to come as a surprise. So, just a quick reminder to help us keep this in our particular context. What we're exploring what we're exploring more generally here is the possible value of, so in the whole series, is the possible value of ethics beyond religion, sort of as a path to a common way to practice ethics as humans, as distinct from ethics against or ethics without religion. So we're not making a case, I'm not making a case here for ethics against religion or ethics without religion. I'm making a case for ethics beyond religion. If I do a good job of my job in the next few minutes, hopefully that distinction should become a little bit more nuanced and I hope also a little bit more meaningful. So just a little bit of what I'm going to call drive-by history to get us started. Very broad brush here. For thousands of years, religion has been at the heart of human civilization. We've gathered around it. We've made philosophy and culture with and out of it. We've gone to war about it. We've conflated it with preferred ideologies of all stripes to leverage our preferences and so on. Given how central religion has been, I think it's hardly a surprise that concern for others, the basic inner values that are related to that concern, things like kindness, honesty, patience, forgiveness, have for a long time been understood and communicated within society in religious terms. That's been the framework that has largely carried those values into culture making and into society. And in all the world's major religions, both theistic and non-theistic, and we'll break that difference down shortly, these values, as well as other values like self-discipline, contentment, generosity, they've been presented and they've been celebrated as the keys to living a meaningful and worthwhile life. Live like this, that's the best way to live. And a good life has been understood in that context as a life that contains the practice of those sorts of ethics. That's what it means to live a good life. And that's why, for instance, people who understand Jesus to also be God might come up with a movement that produces bracelets that ask, what would Jesus do? So like in the context of that way of thinking about ethics and religion, that makes perfect sense, right? You're actually trying to answer the question of how shall we live? And that's the example you're looking to. The answer to that question, what would Jesus do within that sort of a system of belief, is also the answer to the question, how might I live and have a good life? Those are folded together. If we think about the central concern of what the central concern of religions usually is, this wouldn't feel like a surprise, right? Religions of all kinds are mostly concerned with the human spirit, sometimes in ways or to degrees that might even make our bodies into enemies, right? This is if we grew up in Christendom and anybody that we were around in terms of teaching sacred texts and that taught anything Pauline, anything from the writings of Paul, we're familiar with this idea that we have to bludgeon our bodies to free our spirits, right? Given that emphasis on spirit, it follows that the practice of these kinds of inner values, which tend to bring with them benefits to our own spiritual well-being and to the spiritual well-being of those around us, would be integral to any meaningful religious practice. Kind of follows, right? There's a strong internal logic to that. If that feels to you like there are a lot of qualifiers in that sentence, that's deliberate on my part. My experience personally and my observation generally, particularly at this moment in history, is that it's more and more common for religion to be practiced in ways that are divorced from this understanding of their purpose. It's more and more common for religion to be exercised societally in ways that are not paying attention to that strong, deep, historic emphasis, the ethical emphasis. They're too often co-opted by other ideologies or by identity politics, or they get offered in service of getting people on my side to meaningfully engage with, and with all of those other things going on, it's like religion is preoccupied with that, and so it doesn't meaningfully engage with this historical central purpose of nurturing spiritual well-being. So you can get religion that has almost nothing to do with the wellness of the spirit. Maybe that's why so many are leaving religion. Because in so many instances it's become, at least in terms of what its core purpose has been for thousands of years, kind of useless. And in any case, from the perspective of history, the practice of inner spiritual values has been central. That's, like I said, drive-by history, but pretty hard to argue with that, I think. Not like there hasn't been other things going on, of course, but that's been its central purpose. Now, about that tension between self-interest and the common good that I mentioned earlier, The parallel idea that I want to unpack a little bit stands on the notion that we can group most religions into one of two categories, theistic religions and non-theistic religions. This will be a review for some of us. It might be fall under, I've never really thought about that for others, but stay with me. I'm headed for an intersection that I think will welcome all of us. Theistic religions would include Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Sikhism, Zoroastrianism, Islam. Those are sort of the big players in the theistic religions side of the conversation. And in those traditions, ethics is ultimately grounded in some understanding of God, some story about the divine as creator and the ground of all that is. Don't want to get stuck in the weeds here, but for any of you who've read the philosopher and theologian Paul Tillich, who describes God as the ground of all being, that's different. That's actually in a space between theism and non-theism. It's one of the reasons why his work remains intriguing well after he's been gone. But generally speaking, in the theistic religions, it's the story about the divine as a creator and the ground of all it is. That's what grounds the ethic. So put it another way, in these traditions, theistic traditions, everything that is comes from God. And from that point of view, the entire universe is part of a divine creation, part of a divine plan, and that makes the very fabric of the universe in those traditions sacred, because it comes from God, right? In the beginning was the Word, right? So before there was anything material, there was the divine. So that's a text that sort of reflects that understanding. And since God in these traditions is understood as infinite love or infinite compassion, loving others is part of loving and serving God within those traditions, right? That's the connecting point. Also, in many theistic traditions, there's a belief that after death, we will face divine judgment. And that provides additional incentive for sort of staying on the good path while here on earth. There's a pretty strong sort of carrot and stick kind of arrangement inside of that way of thinking. Live an ethical life, and it'll be better now, or as good as it can be now, and certainly better forever, right? So that's the carrot and the stick part. Now, to be perhaps unappealingly pragmatic about this, does it work? Well, I think in many instances the answer is yes. Because if, as humans, we take this seriously, we believe what I just described, submission to God can have a powerful positive effect on things like reducing self-centeredness. And as a result, it can provide substantial foundation for a very secure ethical and even an altruistic outlook. I don't know about you, but I know lots of people who've done lots of good in the world because of their theistic faith. So it can do that. I think, for example, close to home, I think about the wall in my dad's construction office, which had in clear view of anyone who came into the office a framed print that asked, "What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" If you saw my dad in his desk, you saw that, which for those not familiar is a verse from the Bible. It's from Mark 8:36. I would say that the practical ways in which my dad kept that in view as he did business had a lot to do with the fact that people trusted him to be a person of integrity in all of his dealings, including those where there was probably some legal wiggle room. I think Dad had the follow-up verse in mind as well. It wasn't on the plaque, but the follow-up verse says, "Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" So basically, what price for a soul? And the reason I think he had that in mind is because he steadfastly refused to trade time and energy focused on what he thought mattered most in order to make just a little bit more money or gain a bit more status. He was pretty adamant about keeping that in balance. From his point of view, given what I just described, what was at stake wasn't just, say, his family, but his soul. That was the connection, right? And he died at peace, having had the satisfaction of providing well for his family and contributing to his community and so on, right? So did it work? Yeah, it worked. On the other hand, in non-theistic religions such as Buddhism, Jainism, some branches of some ancient Indian religions, there's no belief in a divine creator. And by the way, we can easily get this confused with indigenous spirituality, where creator language gets used, but creator is actually not a personification of the divine. Creator is actually nature, more commonly in Eurocentric language. It's not a father figure. But because of the influence of Christianity in many communities, that terrain can get extremely murky. But all to say, Buddhism, Jainism, some branches of ancient Indian religions, quite clearly there's no belief in a divine creator. And what we find there instead is the core principle of causality. The universe in those belief systems is regarded as beginningless. There's no beginning point. It's isness. If this makes your brain hurt, and not the least of the reasons might be that your brain's not used to thinking this way. Millions of people do not find this a difficult idea. And I think that's just the discomfort that naturally accompanies the unfamiliar. It's worth remembering, a little aside, but it's worth remembering that discomfort and danger are not synonymous. And that we can't learn something new without displacing something old, which is bound to cause some disruption. I realize that that's tricky terrain because some experiences of danger impact us so deeply that discomfort and danger do become synonymous in our lived experience. And, you know, we use a word like trauma sometimes for that, right? In any case, without a creator figure in which to ground inner values and an ethical life, because there is no figure like that in the non-theistic religions, non-theistic religions still have a grounding for ethics. They ground ethics in the idea of karma. Now, a little pause for what might be a course correction here for some of us. Lots of us, when we think of karma, automatically think of reincarnation. And in some contexts, those ideas overlap pretty vigorously. We'll talk about that in a moment. So that's not a surprise that we might find ourselves thinking that way. But to have a better understanding of karma, we need to dig into its background just a little bit. Even linguistically, the Sanskrit word karma, because that is a Sanskrit word, simply means, it doesn't mean more or less than this, simply means action. So the word karma just means action. So when we talk about our karma, we're referring to all intentional acts of body, speech, and mind. That's what that word means. And when we talk about the fruits of our karma, we're talking about the consequences of those acts. So if anybody in your life ever said to you something like, just remember that actions have consequences, they might not have used the language of karma, but if they had known the language of karma and they had used it, they would have been using it in a way that was linguistically accurate. That's what karma is. Actions have consequences. And that belief, in fact, you could correctly say, and the teachers from within the tradition do say, that doctrine of karma is grounded in the observation of causality as a law of nature. Right? Painting a lot of things with one swipe of the brush here, but what that comes down to is every intended action, word, or thought we have, and intention matters in these belief systems, right? We can have good intentions and our actions might still go awry because we don't have limitless agency. But every intended action, word, or thought that we have has a potentially unending stream of consequences. So that's the notion of karma. And when you combine that idea with the idea of the rebirth of successive lives, for example, that can form a pretty powerful basis for ethics and the cultivation of inner values. Kind of makes sense, right? There's an endless stream of consequences from your intentions, thoughts, and actions, and you might have to live with and in that stream because you keep coming back and experiencing it. Yeah, you want to pay some attention to your karma, right? To your actions, because that's a long road. That similar better life now and ongoing kind of carrot and stick concept is present in non-theistic religions, but it's grounded differently. How's your head doing so far? So to just kind of recap, to some extent, all religions, both theistic and non-theistic, ground the cultivation of inner values and ethical awareness in some kind of metaphysical, not empirically demonstrable, understanding of the world and of life after death. Both of those big baskets operate that way. In theistic religions, the doctrine of divine judgment underlies ethical teachings. In non-theistic religions, the underpinning is the doctrine of karma and future lives, right? All to say, in both frameworks, the ones that have a divinity and the ones that don't, these understandings are super important because they provide the motivation to live ethically. And they also provide the foundation for the hope of salvation or liberation, sort of depending what kind of language or pictures you're using for that. So that's a pretty powerful 1-2 punch, right? It means that for those who take their religion seriously, whether that's in a theistic framework or a non-theistic framework, the pursuit of an ethical life and their ultimate spiritual aspirations are inseparable. How you live and how it's going to go after you die are locked together in both those systems. So, to circle back to our previous talky bit on this topic. At the start of this talky bit, I referred back to what we were on about a couple of weeks ago, this idea that if people leave religion behind, not much might change. For all kinds of reasons that are beyond the scope of this exploration, I don't think that there's any real likelihood of finding ourselves in a fully secular society anytime soon, for good or for ill. We need our explainer stories, and if history is any indication, a significant percentage of those stories are likely to be religious in shape. Thousands and thousands of years. I don't think we're going to jump the traces fully on that anytime soon. Those stories are powerful. And also, faith can be a force for good and of great benefit. It can bring people together. It can give guidance and solace. It can offer a vision of the good life for people to strive for. It can give strength and hope to people that are facing adversity. But, and here's the question that I think can inform the common ground that I mentioned earlier. Here's the question: is religion indispensable to spiritual life? It may or may not facilitate spiritual life. We already talked about that. But is it necessary to spiritual life? Distinguishably different question. Well, if the I'm spiritual but not religious stats are any indication, that ship's already sailed on that question for millions of people. Right? That's what that phrase means. My spirituality is separated from religion. I'm spiritual but not religious. It's not a complicated sentence in this regard. But I can't help but wonder if there might be some value in considering the why of that. For many people, perhaps including many who find the explorations of this community interesting or helpful, the why has been some version of disaffection, disappointment, hurt, even trauma. Like, why would we separate? Why would we go travel toward I'm spiritual but not religious? A lot of those reasons are, not all, but a lot of them are not from positive experiences. And then, we've also considered, there's the impact of science as an explainer story. If I'm going to travel down the path of spiritual but not religious, it's an open question, what foundation might my spirituality stand on? And to nuance this just a little bit, when I say I want to be spiritual but not religious or identify as spiritual but not religious, do I really mean not religious? Or do I more likely mean I'm not the religion I grew up with? Because those are not the same thing. Or do I mean something even more nuanced, like religion is not what comes first? Spirituality comes first, and religion might be the way I practice certain aspects of it. Or do I have the values from the religion I grew up with, but not those core beliefs that ground it, not that picture of a divinity in judgment, for example? Okay, so this can get, you know, the tangled webs we weave and all of that. And it's worth remembering that as we've considered, non-theistic beliefs are also religion. This is one of the places where the book, I think, I haven't read the book, but as I understood sort of the summary of it, where the book actually probably didn't, where would you stop with this? So as a researcher, I can appreciate them choosing their scope, but didn't really entertain thoroughly the question of what does this question look like from a non-theistic point of view. They were primarily examining people whose religious beliefs would have been theistic. So that's kind of interesting in itself. That's a different book. Let me put this into a different kind of question. What sort of motivation to act ethically might work if we're not going to depend on traditional beliefs? We're going to be spiritual but not religious. Let me put this out there for our consideration and our musing. If we can accept or even consider the possibility that human beings can manage without religion, as the authors of the book we talked about a couple of weeks ago suggest, can we manage? So if we can manage without religion, the question that follows that is, can we manage well without inner values? And I'm going to say that to me, that seems pretty unlikely. I think it would be pretty difficult for us to form good world, make good culture, make good societies without inner values. I can imagine it actually relatively easily without religion, because religion can function in so many different ways. But without inner values, yeah. That I find a reach. And I know that we can choose to regard the world as only material. That's one of the options, right? There is no spirit. And that kind of takes care of this question. It just gets set to the side entirely. But that's a pretty hard road to travel. To be an unmitigated materialist is an extremely challenging worldview. And I don't think there are very many people who actually integrally choose it. I think some people gesture toward it, but if there's mystery in their world, they're not fully a materialist, right? Like, that's the way I would understand that, for good or for ill. And for those who do choose that path, I would contend that behaving ethically becomes more difficult than it would otherwise be, in no small part because it's hard to know where to ground your ethic, other than in your own preferences as an individual. So now we're potentially sort of on the short path to anarchy, right, in terms of ethics. Everybody's just, like, deciding for themselves. There is no common ground. No. Historically, that hasn't gone that great. So how about this? Put it out here broadly speaking, and we'll wrap this up, and we can go away and think about it or not as we choose. What happens if we think about human spirituality as having two dimensions? The first is what we could call spiritual well-being. We could think about that as inner mental and emotional strength, balance, and so on. The what's happening inside of us for which we might use the language of spirit. That doesn't depend on religion, but it comes down to our innate human nature as beings naturally disposed toward things like kindness, compassion, caring for others. We wouldn't be here if we hadn't been so inclined. The species wouldn't have survived if we hadn't figured out the value of and ways of helping one another. For those of us that were taught that human beings are fatally flawed, fallen perhaps, this in itself, as an idea, might be a reach. We might find it difficult to think of human nature in those charitable terms. But stay with me for a moment. The second dimension is what we could call religion-based spirituality, which we acquire from our upbringing and our culture, and it's tied to particular beliefs and practices, including beliefs like the ones I just mentioned. And here's where we finally get to the subject line from the blurb. This illustration is not original to me, but when I read it, I was like, I can taste that. I can imagine that. What happens if we think about the difference between those two as being a little bit like, so the difference between sort of our spiritual well-being being based in this nature idea of innate human nature, naturally being disposed toward kindness, compassion, and caring, and the second dimension being religious-based spirituality, which has that story structure that I mentioned. If we think about the difference between those two as being a little bit like the difference between water and tea. Ethics and inner values without religious content, because they can exist without religious content, for millions of people they do. Ethics and inner values without religious content, we could think of like water. We need it. We need it every day for health, even for survival. We can't do without it. We can kind of fake it for a little while, but doesn't take very long before we're in serious trouble if we don't have water, right? So we need inner values, not optional. Ethics and inner values based in religious content are more like tea. Tea is mostly water, but it has some other ingredients. In our household, quite a variety of ingredients, potentially. In our household, we've got a rather large box filled with varieties of tea. There are lots of options, and they're all labeled. They're distinguishable from one another, but they're all tea. But when we make tea, it's still mostly water. The ingredients are fascinating. Tea leaves, spices, mysterious ground-up organics of all sorts. That makes whatever's in my cup potentially more nutritious, more sustaining, more interesting for sure, if tea is our thing. Some of it's in bags, some of it's loose. No matter how they're prepared or presented, the primary ingredient is always water. We can live without tea, but we can't live without water. We are born free of religion. It's learned, it's acquired, but we are not born, for example, free of the need for compassion. So, to close the loop a little bit, we could put it this way. As important as religion might be, no contention with that from my perspective. I would argue that it stands on our basic human spirituality. We have an underlying disposition toward love, kindness, affection, whether we have a religious framework or not. That's why those values show up in all the enduring religions. Because no matter who's making the religious story, that stuff's in it. Historically, religions that haven't contained this have not survived. That's why the great religions, in the sense of enduring religions, all have these values in them. And when we cultivate those values, which are values that I would also contend that we all appreciate in others, what happens is when we cultivate those values, that's when we start to live spiritually. So that's why we can be in a religious system, for example, that isn't cultivating those values, and recognize it, if we stand back from it at any distance, as not good. It still has the name of a religion, but it is no longer doing the job that our human experience of inner values calls for religions to do well, if they're going to be a good religion. Because the values were there first, and then we made a religion out of them. It doesn't make religion unimportant. It doesn't mean we can't have religion and spirituality, but it means that we can have religion without spirituality, and we can have spirituality without religion. Water and tea. We might choose to express or support those inner values with religious beliefs. We might not. And in the final event, we might have preferences when it comes to our tea, but what we have in common is our need for water, for inner and spiritual values. That's the ground that I would argue we all stand on, is that need. And beyond that, we're choosers and we're makers. We have some agency in this. So we should do what we can to think deeply and choose well around this. But I think, to me, that was a picture where I was like, yeah, I can, at least personally, I'm not trying to insist on this for everyone, but from my vantage point, I'm like, that helped me picture this dilemma in a different way. And I found it helpful. So I offer it to you. Not with the assumption that it will be helpful, but with the hope that it will. Peace.